Our broadcast expert and writer at The Cradle for more about it in Fake News Exposé. Now, the Israeli occupation forces carried out a massacre in Rafah last week, as they portrayed it as a victorious rescue operation that matched their American Super Bowl ad theme. While the hostages were actually not rescued on the 12th of February, they were rescued on the 2nd of February. Now, Fuad, that sounds like a scene from a B-rated Hollywood movie, if I'm correct here.
Definitely.
What happened exactly?
Okay, so since the massacre in Rafah last week, which killed 100 people, over 100 people, including women and children. Mm-hmm. We've seen a lot of reports that the prisoners, the Israeli prisoners that they said were freed during that military operation, as they called it, were actually released earlier than they said.
Two men taken captive by Hamas on the 7th of October were rescued on Monday by Israeli military. During the early morning raid, Israel carried out airstrikes that the Hamas-run health ministry said killed around 100 people in the southern city of Rafah in Gaza. The two men, Luis Har and Fernando Marman, had been kidnapped in the kibbutz of Nir Yitzhak and had spent 128 days in captivity. But according to some social media users, Har and Marman were not freed during this assault on Monday, but were actually rescued by the Israel Defense Forces, or the IDF, more than a month ago. Some shared what they claim is a screenshot of an article in Haaretz, an Israeli newspaper, which says the two hostages were released in an operation by the IDF on the 2nd of February 2024. Others tweeted this screenshot of another alleged article appearing this time in the Times of Israel, which claims one of the hostages, Luis Har, was rescued in December 2023. Some believe this is proof Israel staged a fake hostage liberation as an excuse to attack the city of Rafah. We looked at the Haaretz website and we found the original article about the hostages released, and it does say the two men were released on the 12th of February, so the correct date. This means the screenshot that has been circulating online has been doctored. As for the second screenshot, which shows the Times of Israel article, well, we can check using a tool called Wayback Machine, which shows us how a web page has been modified over time.
So far, even Zionist media was saying that the operation might not have happened in February 12, actually in February 2, or in December, but they had then reneged on what they said. What was that about?
Listen, it's very possible that Haaretz went in and changed the date afterwards, because at the end of the day, we know that Israeli media is subject to strict military censorship laws. So if the army says they have to change something, they're going to have to change it. But there was actually a Mayadeen report that came out afterwards that said that these two prisoners, first of all, they were released. They were actually released on the 12th of February, but not in a heroic military operation like the Israelis said. These two captives were, according to the report, were actually being held not by Hamas, but by a Palestinian family in Rafah.
Wow.
And the story is that the Israelis agreed to a deal where they would pay a sum of money for these to the family for these prisoners.
So that might have been possibly what happened instead of what Israel said. What do you have more for us on that?
The next thing we have is this CBN report, which jumps directly into Israeli propaganda about Rafah. It's talking about how Hamas rules the city, how the city of Rafah is key to Hamas's survival. And it goes on to talk about, you know, these stories of Hamas diverting humanitarian aid, having a stranglehold over aid. So
Israel's operation into Rafah has begun with airstrikes. Since it's on the Egyptian border, Prime Minister Netanyahu promised coordination with Egypt. For now, Hamas rules Rafah, a key city to its survival. Some analysts believe Hamas uses the area to keep a stranglehold on the humanitarian aid coming into Gaza, a major way to control the people of Gaza. Hamas uses more than a million Gazans who have fled to Rafah as human shields. NBC is reporting Israel is open to allowing Hamas mastermind Yahya Sinwar to go into exile in exchange for the release of all the hostages and the end of Hamas rule in the Gaza Strip.
Wow. So what happened right there?
Well, they're basically saying with zero evidence that Hamas has some kind of stranglehold over humanitarian aid in Rafah, and that this is how Hamas controls the population of Gaza and the Palestinian people. Actually, the other day it was reported that even U.S. intelligence believes there's no evidence for any such thing. Mm-hmm. There's no evidence, even U.S. intelligence said it, there's no evidence that Hamas diverts humanitarian aid, has a stranglehold on it in any way, mm-hmm. or uses it for its own benefit. Mm-hmm.
That seems weird enough.
So the next thing we have is a CBS reporter sitting down for an interview with what she says is a Hamas commander in the occupied West Bank. Mm-hmm. Of course, Hamas's presence in the occupied West Bank is used by Western media to justify more violence there.
Support for Hamas has soared from 14 to 42% since October 7th, according to a recent poll. We met a Hamas commander at an undisclosed location in the West Bank.
Are you a wanted man?
I am, indeed.
Calling himself Abu Abed, he joined 9 years ago when he was just 16. Almost half that time was spent in jail. Now he is a Hamas recruiter.
Are you seeing more young people joining Hamas here in the West Bank since October 7th?
For sure. All the Palestinian people are standing by Hamas. I give the fighters guidance. When Israeli forces enter, I tell them what to do and how to open fire.
So far, we're supposed to believe that Deborah Pata actually met with a Hamas reporter in the West Bank. Is that supposedly true?
Well, as we can tell from the first sentence, the accent sounds entirely fake. Mm-hmm. Anyone who speaks Arabic will know that. And we also know from the past, especially the last few months, mm-hmm. is that Israel regularly uses crisis actors and impersonators mm-hmm. when they want to portray evidence for something that they don't have.
It is true.
That's not to say that there isn't Hamas in the West Bank. There is Hamas in the West Bank. There's Palestinian Islamic Jihad. There's mm-hmm. Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade. There are many, many affiliates of the Gaza resistance in the West Bank. Mm-hmm. But they don't look like this, and mm-hmm. they don't sound like this. And, of course, they're too busy resisting the occupation to sit down with a news team of this kind.
Definitely. I second that. But I want to thank you very much for your analysis with
us, Fuad,
today for being with us. Ladies and gents, let's move to mainstream media expose. When we or any other media platform says that the Israeli regime represented by its Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu lies about their genocide in Gaza, about killing Hamas leaders in Gaza, or about saving their hostages, we don't say it out of spite. We simply repeat what the leaders of the Israeli regime themselves are saying. With us is Ms. Julia Qasim, our mainstream media expert, to tell us more about this. Thank you very much for being with us. Julia, what do you have for us today?
Thank you, Marwa. Hello. Well, indeed, the Zionist media has been all over the place mm-hmm. accusing the Zionist PM Benjamin Netanyahu mm-hmm. of lying to the Israeli public, mm-hmm. the Israeli occupation public, and the world when he speaks about talking about Hamas, taking them out, or releasing all the hostages, which everybody knows at this point is mm-hmm. not true. The Zionist Jerusalem Post, for one, quoted former IOF Deputy Chief Yair Golan, saying that when Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu tells the Israeli entity public that it is possible to kill entire Hamas leadership and to save all the Israeli hostages at all time, he's lying. Mm-hmm. So speaking from Reichman University, Golan said that Netanyahu's cabinet must first return the hostages, which is necessitated by stopping the aggression on Gaza. Only later can they hope to reach Hamas, with the key being preventing Hamas from retaining control over Gaza. Mm-hmm. But of course, this is necessitated by the ceasefire that the Zionist entity has rejected 3 times. So Golan in the piece also even accused Netanyahu's policy of weakening the Palestinian Authority and stabilizing Hamas in 2009 as being one of the key sources leading to the October 7th Israeli entity failure to stop Hamas's operation.
So now he's pinning what happened in October 7th on the Benjamin Netanyahu government to begin with.
Right, and also going full circle in this narrative mm-hmm. that he inadvertently propped up Hamas's power, which is a false narrative that mm-hmm. you hear all the time. But as the continuous series of whitewashing the Zionist crimes against the Palestinian people goes on, the Wall Street Journal published an opinion piece written by none other than the Zionist entity president himself, Isaac Herzog.
Wow.
It's entitled, "The Case Against Israel Rests on Lies." So it claims that South Africa grossly distorted in its presentation a quote by Herzog himself to the ICJ in its ongoing investigation mm-hmm. of the Israeli genocide. So in this piece, Herzog was clearly frustrated because South Africa was very tentative to his words, taken from a news conference on October 12th, just 5 days after the Al-Aqsa flood operation began. The quote, which included a line that, quote, the entire nation out there that is responsible, end quote, referring to the Palestinians. Herzog did not like the fact that his own words condemn him and basically are evidence that of his genocidal intent. Because, of course, they justified the killing of Palestinian civilians.
And that quote was used against the Zionist Israeli entity in the ICJ, wasn't it?
South Africa used what Herzog described as a misconstrued quote at The Hague to prove Zionist Israel's intent to commit genocide and thus invoke a jurisdiction of the court. So then in the same article, the Wall Street Journal publishes a video of the Zionist Israeli ambassador to the UN, Gilad Erdan, justifying his regime's genocide in Gaza. So let's hear what he had to say in the video.
Well, Erdogan usually has a lot to say.
How can one call for a ceasefire and at the same time claim to seek a solution to the conflict? After all, anyone who supports a ceasefire basically supports Hamas' continued reign of terror in Gaza.
What was he talking about?
So you see, Marwa, the Zionist Israeli ambassador to the UN openly claimed that anyone who asks for a ceasefire in Gaza basically supports what Erdogan called Hamas' continued reign of terror in Gaza. A video published to support an opinion piece by the Israeli head of entity head of state maintaining that accusations of genocide against the Israeli regime are false.
So he's basically saying that if anyone says, oh, look, Israel is bombing civilians, they should stop, actually supports what he said, violence and terrorism. I think that's like literally what the definition of playing victim is that we have always seen the Zionist entity play when it comes to something that is not against its interests, doesn't it?
Exactly, and just invokes this ad hominem. Everything that is criticism against their genocide is Hamas.
I want to thank you very much, Ms. Julia Qasim, for being with us to talk more about the what the mainstream media has been telling us for the past week, especially about Rafah and about the horrors that the Israeli entity has been putting against the people in Gaza. Now, ladies and gents, let's move on to social media expose. Now, social media platforms have been the perfect place to expose the Zionist Israeli genocidal intentions towards Palestinians and the Western regime's false claims of securing human rights and freedom of expression. Here is our own social media expert, Ms. Seema Itayim, who is also an editor at The Cradle. Seema, where has that train, if you will, of Western faux freedom of speech stopped this week?
Thanks for having me, Marwa. So the train has stopped at the Tech Transparency Project station. Tech Transparency Project is an information and research hub that seeks to hold big tech accountable. So anyway, they've published a few days ago, on February 14, an investigation, what they claim to be an investigation. They are bothered that X is allowing freedom of speech for certain individuals and entities in West Asia.
Wow.
So Tech Transparency Project, who is, by the way, funded by openly Zionist entities and individuals, including David Magerman, Open Society Foundations, which we all know, Craig Newmark, Philanthropies, Bohemian Foundation, and Omid Yad Network, found that Elon Musk's X, formerly Twitter, appears to be selling premium services to individuals, groups, and countries that are deemed to be a threat to the U.S. national security.
Oh, the horror.
Right. So TTP, Tech Transparency Project, pointed out more than a dozen X accounts belonging to U.S.-sanctioned entities that had a blue check mark. Now, the blue check mark requires the purchase of a premium subscription. Along with the check marks, which grant legitimacy, X promises a variety of perks for premium accounts, like being able to post longer text and videos, and greater visibility for certain posts. So some of the accounts that TTP was irritated by included Lebanese Hezbollah officials and media, Ansar Allah-affiliated media, and Iranian media, of course, including Press TV.
Well, I would like to remind our viewers that Press TV is specially designated national subject to U.S.-imposed Iran sanctions for 2018 executive order and secondary sanctions because they rule the world, don't they? According to what's known as the OFAC's database. Now, the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcast, also the IRIB, is also a specially designated national subject to U.S. People need to know this. About what the U.S. is doing. It's under a U.S. sanction that says Iran Threat Reduction and Syria Human Rights Act of 2012 and a secondary action. So the CIA expects the X platform to abide by the CIA's own illegal sanctions now?
Pretty much. And a lot of people have been triggered by this, not just TTP, this rage against the Elon Musk machine, which we've seen for several reasons in recent months. So this brought about some posts on X, like that of this account, Pete Quiley, at PQ Politics, who attempted to kickstart some kind of campaign with hashtags that were never picked up to become visible, let alone trending even.
Well, that's...
Hashtag Elon Musk is a national security threat. And hashtag Elon Musk is a traitor.
I'm surprised I didn't pick up.
Right. So he's a national security threat for allowing national security threats to have premium features on X,
to express their thought.
Yes. Another tweet by Spyro's Ghost with an ironic handle, at anti-toxic people, claimed that terrorists are paying for checkmarks on X, as a report shows that Elon Musk's X has accepted payments for subscriptions from entities barred from doing business in the United States, a potential violation of sanctions.
A violation of sanctions, but it's not a violation of an entire human rights law and human rights principles to bomb indiscriminately people all over the world. But if you have those same people who are being bombed having a voice, it becomes so much triggering, doesn't
it? Exactly. And it just, it's, you know, state media is only a problem when it depends what state that is, according to them. So,
well, Seema, it's always a pleasure to have you with us to comment on what's happening on social media. Thank you very much
you.
For your time and your contribution to Exposé. Now, ladies and gents, stay with us. We will go now to Figures Exposé. Now, a new poll shows that Zionist Israel's war in Gaza is taking a heavy mental toll on people across West Asia and North Africa. The Qatar-based Arab Center for Research and Policy Studies announced the results of the survey of 8,000 men and women from 16 Arab countries carried out from December 12, 2023 to January 5th, 2024. Now, a staggering 97% of respondents say they felt psychological stress during this war on Gaza, with 84% of them reporting experiencing this to a great degree. Now, almost 4 in 5 said they follow news about the brutal campaign every day or maybe several times a week. Now, a majority of respondents said that Arab governments should suspend ties of normalization of relations with the Israelis as the top of second most important measure to stop the war. The survey also found that 92% believe the Palestinian cause is an issue for all Arabs, and not just the Palestinian people, up from 70% from 2022. The same poll also found that 69% of Arabs stand with the people of Gaza and the Palestinian resistance, Hamas. Now, let us move on to the most notable expose voices for this week. Now, all eyes were on Rafah last week, as they are this week too, after the February 12 massacre committed by Zionist Israel. One notable video on Instagram by the Palestinian youth movement with 513,000 followers base posted a video saying that the U.S.-backed Zionist genocide on Gaza has reached a new urgent stage with nowhere further south for Palestinians to evacuate. Here's the Palestinian youth movement's voice.
All eyes on Rafah. At about 3 a.m. Gaza local time, the genocidal Israeli regime began its strikes on Rafah, on land, air, and sea. Over 100 martyrs and over 250 injured have been reported in the U.S.-funded Israeli strikes, targeting homes and mosques where many were sheltering. Rafah now houses about 1.4 million, which whom are crowded into displacement tents and apartment buildings, have nowhere else to go. With their backs against the closed Egyptian border, the Israelis have begun their merciless bombing of civilians. According to the local Kuwait hospital, in the span of 1 hour, 100-plus civilians have been confirmed killed, most of them children, and 250-plus injured, numbers that have likely increased This is all after Netanyahu rejected a peace deal for ceasefire, claiming that they will continue until total victory. Since the start of Israel's murderous campaign, which has resulted in over 28,000 Palestinian martyrs, total victory has always meant ethnic cleansing and erasure of the Palestinian people. We call on the U.S. and its Western allies to stop arming Israel and for an immediate and permanent ceasefire.
Now, another voice on TikTok that became an eye-opening account when it comes to the Zionist Israeli genocide on Gaza is Frederick Joseph. In his video, Frederick says that the Israeli entity is gaslighting the world when it comes to Rafah. Here is Frederick's voice.
So as I record this, Israel is in the midst of absolutely decimating Rafah. And for those of you who are not familiar with Rafah, Rafah is in Gaza, and it is one of the safe zones, the quote-unquote safe zones, that Israel told Palestinians to flee to as they were bombing other areas. Now they are bombing the area that they told people to go to. And because they told everyone to go there, Rafah has become the most densely populated place on the entire planet. Like literally, that's not like hyperbolic. It is the most densely populated place in the world. And they are currently bombing it. And, you know, as I've brought this point up and talked about, you know, what Israel's doing, and, you know, for months and months now.
Ladies and gents, with that, we conclude our expose for tonight. Stay tuned for more eye-opening investigations on Expose. The truth is just a revelation away.
A diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In Britain, leading doctors have said more than a third of cancer patients in England are facing potentially deadly delays, with thousands of people forced to wait months to begin their treatment. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Research has revealed cancer patients in the United Kingdom wait up to 7 weeks longer to begin radiotherapy or chemotherapy than people in comparable countries. The stark findings are yet more damning evidence of the extent to which the United Kingdom lags behind other nations, as experts warn that people's chances of survival are being affected by long waits for treatment. In the first research of its kind, experts at University College London analysed data from more than 780,000 cancer patients diagnosed between 2012 and 2017 in four comparable countries: Australia, Canada, Norway, and the United Kingdom. Eight cancer types were included: esophageal cancer, stomach cancer, colon cancer, rectal cancer, liver cancer, pancreatic cancer, lung cancer, and ovarian cancer. The two studies, published in Lancet Oncology, were the first to examine treatment differences for eight cancer types in countries across three continents. The research found British patients experienced the longest waits for cancer treatment. The average time to start chemotherapy was 48 days in England, 57 in Northern Ireland, 58 days in Wales, and 65 days in Scotland. The shortest time was 39 days in Norway. In radiotherapy, Britain fared even worse. It took 53 days on average for treatment to begin in Northern Ireland, 63 days on average for treatment to begin in England, 79 days on average for treatment to begin in Scotland, and 81 days on average for treatment to begin in Wales. In Newfoundland, Canada, which had the best record, the average wait was 42 days. Compared with Newfoundland, waits for radiotherapy in Northern Ireland were 11 days longer. In England, it was 3 weeks longer, and in Scotland and Wales, it was 7 weeks longer. The research also found that in the United Kingdom, a lower proportion of people with cancer were given chemotherapy and radiotherapy than in other countries. 59% of ovarian cancer patients in the United Kingdom received chemotherapy, compared with 67% in Canada, 72% in Norway, and 73% in Australia. The same was true for pancreatic cancer patients, 27% in Britain, compared with 41% in Canada, 44% in Norway, and 47% in Australia. The study showed that older patients were the least likely to receive chemotherapy and radiotherapy treatment, particularly in Britain. For example, 2% of UK patients aged 85 and over received chemotherapy, compared with 8% in Australia and 14% in Ontario, Canada. Although not all patients need them, chemotherapy and radiotherapy are key treatment options. The International Cancer Benchmarking Partnership research found countries with better cancer survival rates typically made greater use of chemotherapy and radiotherapy and had shorter waits for treatment. Cancer Research UK, which part-funded the two studies, said delays to begin treatment were partly a result of the British government's lack of long-term planning on cancer in recent years. It said countries with robust cancer strategies backed by funding had seen better improvements in survival rates. The charity said the National Health Service workforce crisis was also a barrier to delivering treatment as far as cancer patients were concerned. Michelle Mitchell, its chief executive, said, "When it comes to treating cancer, timing really matters. We can learn a great deal from other countries who have stepped up and substantially improved cancer services. With a general election on the horizon, the British government has a real opportunity to buck the trend we see in this research and do better for people affected by cancer." Dr. John Butler, a cancer surgeon and clinical lead for the International Cancer Benchmarking Partnership, said, "Lower use of chemotherapy and radiotherapy in the United Kingdom could impact people's chances of survival, especially for older patients." He said cancer survival in the United Kingdom remained about 10 to 15 years behind that in other countries, adding, "This study captures missed opportunities for patients in the United Kingdom to receive life-prolonging treatment." The Department of Health and Social Care said it had invested significantly in cancer care since the period covered by the research, including £162 million on radiotherapy equipment and £2.3 billion on community diagnostic centres. A spokesperson for the Department of Health and Social Care claimed, "Survival rates are also improving across almost all types of cancers." The website Press Reader has also covered the same story and tells us more. Leading doctors have said more than a third of cancer patients in England are facing potentially deadly delays, with thousands of people forced to wait months to begin their cancer treatment. According to the latest performance data for England, there has also been a significant surge in people experiencing long waits in accidents and emergency departments, though officials claim the overall National Health Service waiting list continues to fall. Doctors raised concerns that cancer targets across the National Health Service were still being missed, even when somebody has been diagnosed with the disease, with one vital target now not hit for 8 years. The proportion of patients waiting less than 62 days in December from an urgent suspected cancer referral or consultant upgrade to their first definitive treatment for cancer was 65.9%, up slightly from 65.2% in November. The target is 85% and was last met in December of 2015. The figures emerged in the same week that Britain's King Charles III began treatment for cancer within days of being diagnosed. Buckingham Palace has not specified whether the King is receiving private healthcare or being treated under National Health Service. While he's already receiving expert care, his treatment has drawn further attention to the long waiting times in the National Health Service. Professor Pat Price, a leading NHS oncologist and co-founder of the Catch Up with Cancer campaign, said, "Today's National Health Service data shows that more than a third of cancer patients face potentially deadly delays. In December, 7,661 cancer patients waited more than the maximum recommended 62 days to start their cancer treatment, with 2,227 waiting 3 months or more. Meanwhile, the data showed hospitals remained under pressure. The number of people waiting more than 12 hours in accidents and emergency departments from a decision to admit them to actually being admitted to hospital hit 54,308 in January, up sharply from 44,045 in December. This is the second highest figure on record.
Hidden Files.
The scientist gave no mind to security warnings that fateful day. He had to return from his vacation to teach a class the next day and wasn't going to let anyone stand in his way. After 14 years of high security, perhaps he was just ready to face his fate. Whatever it was, he hit the road, and not long afterwards, the news was blasted everywhere in the country. Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, the father of Iran's nuclear science, had joined his martyred colleagues assassinated by the Israeli regime. But just who was Dr. Fakhrizadeh, and what had he done to deserve the honor of martyrdom? And why did the U.S. and Israeli regimes plan this assassination and more in hopes of dismantling Iran's nuclear program? Well, my dear colleague Mariam Azadeh is joining us with a bit of history on this topic. Mariam, please tell us more about Dr. Fakhrizadeh.
Well, thank you, Marzia, and greetings to your audience. Now, over the years, the authorities of the Islamic Republic have declared time and time again that the country's nuclear program is merely for peaceful purposes. Iran signed the Treaty of the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons in 1970, and careful investigations and reports by the International Atomic Energy Agency have shown the Islamic Republic's compliance with the treaty over the years. Even more reassuring than the treaty and the IAEA reports is the clear and strict stance of Islam that is the very foundation of the Islamic Republic. Even at the height of Saddam's invasion of Iran, when the Ba'athist regime in Iraq was bombing Iranian cities with chemical weapons, the late leader of the revolution, Imam Khomeini, declared that it's forbidden for the Iranian military to respond in kind. He himself prevented the production of chemical weapons on the grounds that Islam does not permit using weapons of mass destruction aimed to inflict harm on civilians. Then there's the verdict issued by the current leader of the Islamic Republic, Ayatollah Khamenei, that reaffirms that the use of WMDs using chemical weapons and nuclear weapons is strictly forbidden in Islam. And yet the U.S., with well over 5,000 nuclear warheads, and the Israeli regime, with some 400 nuclear warheads, have committed countless crimes to stop Iran's peaceful nuclear program. But it seems that these crimes have only made Iranians more determined in their pursuit of nuclear technology.
I'm very happy to welcome to Hidden Files two of the sons of Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. We have Dr. Mehdi Fakhrizadeh and Dr. Hamid Fakhrizadeh. Welcome to the program. I'd like to start off with, of course, a very difficult time, the day that your father was assassinated. How did you find out about it?
In the name of the compassionate and merciful God, it was around 2:20 p.m. on November 27, 2020, when my mother called me and altered a sentence that echoed in our minds for 20 years. In that phone call, she simply said to me, "Mehdi, they've shot Dad." A three-word sentence I'd been waiting to hear every day for two decades. At the time of the call, the sounds of explosions and chaos were audible because my mother was the only one with my father. When I inquired about the location of the incident, I learned that the incident had occurred in Absard County. Immediately, we coordinated with my brothers and reached the site. When they had transported my father to Absard facility for initial treatments, we arrived and later, he was airlifted to a hospital in Tehran.
It's so difficult. I can't imagine. And your brother said you were waiting for this for 20 years. What does that mean? What is that like to be waiting to see if your father is going to be killed, become a martyr or not? What does it mean?
As my brother Mehdi mentioned, particularly in the last 15 to 20 years, life had been challenging for us. Despite my father's efforts to prevent security issues and pressures from affecting the family, the created security conditions had entangled the entire family. Nevertheless, he never abandoned his efforts to achieve his goals, which were nothing but the elevation and empowerment of the Islamic Republic of Iran and the country. The first attempt on his life dates back 20 years before his martyrdom, and during these two decades, there were four unsuccessful terrorist operations against him. In a video, Olmert speaks and says, "We wanted to assassinate Fakhrizadeh."
A key part of the plan was to form new organizations to continue the work. This is how Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, head of Project Ahmad, put it. Remember that name, Fakhrizadeh.
And when the reporter asks how well he knows Fakhrizadeh, he replies, "I know him well enough that if I see him in a crowded street, I can easily recognize him."
Well, what about you guys? I mean, did you ever say, "Okay, it's enough. It's too much pressure"?
No, fortunately not. Anyway, a part of these tireless efforts, or as Iran's leader calls them, enduring efforts belongs to our adolescence or a part of our childhood, which we understood to some extent. But our effort was one of our goals, and we are thankful that we were with him in understanding through mutual understanding, companionship, and solidarity.
You said pressure on you and also your children before and still.
Yes.
What kind of pressure right now? What are we talking about right now?
In two or three segments, we can define the pressure on the family. The first segment was before my father was introduced and recognized, meaning the time when he was on the hit list and attempts were made to assassinate him. Incidents had occurred, but intelligence and security services and the Zionist regime had not yet introduced him to the public. These pressures were internal and stemmed from concerns, anxieties, and potential losses. The second segment was when the intelligence services began to introduce him, meaning becoming recognized by the people. When he became known to the public, we too involuntarily became known, meaning we had to answer various questions. In many instances, we denied our relationship to inter-various fields, but in some cases, we couldn't deny it, and various kinds of damage were inflicted upon us. For example, one aspect that was not important to us, but turned out to be a positive outcome, was that many individuals in the business sector cut off their professional ties with us due to concerns that their business connections with us might lead to their sanctions. This was a part of the pressure at the time. After the martyrdom, some of the past pressures lingered, and new pressures were added. I want to mention a small emotional aspect, the loss of a prominent figure, which apart from being a prominent figure in the world and national arena, we have significant effects. We heard that during his lifetime, he was recognized by Foreign Policy magazine as one of 500 powerful figures globally. In any case, the world recognized him as someone who had accomplished significant events. This recognition of his personality also existed within the family. Nevertheless, when this powerful pillar is removed, everyone, relative to the depth of the relationship they had with him, is affected. An example is a question my youngest child, who was only 2 years and a few months old at the time of his martyrdom, still asks me, when will we become martyrs and join Grandpa? I emphasize that the discussion is not merely about his removal or exclusion from the nuclear issue. Of course, the majority of the issue was related to nuclear matters because it was a highly sensitive and a strategic matter for Iran. For Iran's enemies, a country like Iran being equipped with nuclear knowledge independently and without the need for another country with the long-standing sanctions was an unacceptable issue that they could not tolerate.
Okay, let me leave it right there because I'm going to ask a question a little bit later about that particularly. Okay. But you had mentioned about his personality. I want to talk a little bit about who he was as far as a father in the house, just his personality in general, hobbies. Tell me about your father.
It can be said that he had a multidimensional personality. When we look at the personal dimensions, we see he was a poet and a literary individual with a strong interest in literature and involvement in literary matters. In another dimension, when we look at his personality, we see that in the field of philosophy, he had his own opinions and thoughts. His entry into the realm of philosophy dates back to his 16 years of age when he became interested in philosophical subjects. Prominent philosophy professors acknowledged that when he came to the Sadr Philosophy Institute, he raised questions and had answers to those questions that did not even cross their minds. these subjects were not discussed in either the religious or university context, let alone providing answers to them. In the field of management, when you look at him, he managed a complex set of operations in 16 different areas. This involved working with hundreds of scientists and achieving results. One of his oldest colleagues and friends mentioned that Fakhrizadeh did nothing during his 30 years of service unless it was the first time in the country or the world.
What an amazing life that he had. With your father, you said that you had been waiting for that news for 20 years. What would he say to you all? Because obviously he knew that he was a target. What would he tell you about the possibility of him being martyred?
At various times, events occurred, and some of them we became aware of unintentionally, while others needed to be brought to our attention. So he did. Of the four or five instances of assassination attempts that happened to him, perhaps we became aware of one of them after his martyrdom, but we were involved in three or four of them during his lifetime. This was because we also had to be prepared for such events. Preparations had various aspects, and we had to be prepared for after his passing. Perhaps the paternal recommendations or last-minute advices are one of the interesting aspects of such events. Sometimes an individual may give advice once, but for us, within 20 years, we're always involved in these events, as if a person, if their death is destined to happen, experiences it once in a sickness or deathbed, but it was on the brink of such events every day. Therefore, for us, every day was a final day, and he had last-minute recommendations for us every day.
Amazing. Amazing. When did you find out about the type of projects that your father was involved in, or did you find out, did you know the importance of his work?
I have said this in several places. Just as much as my father was unknown to the people in work-related matters, he was also unknown to us. He was never in a situation to talk about projects or the work he was doing and achieving results at home. Even after 3 years, I still hear things about his work and projects that are new to me. Naturally, more than 90% of the activities carried out by Martyr Fakhrizadeh or are currently ongoing are not open for discussion because they are confidential.
Absolutely amazing life. Let me ask you, Mehdi, did you ever think maybe we shouldn't just insist on nuclear technology? For example, the Islamic Republic of Iran, of course, we know that there have been, you've mentioned, several nuclear scientists who have been martyred. We know the Islamic Republic has advanced technologies in various fields, from nano to stem cell technologies and others. What would you say, I mean, if Iran just gave up on its peaceful nuclear program, why not?
There are two discussions or two dimensions here. One is the discussion of nuclear energy, the discussion of nuclear technology and nuclear knowledge. We're not only talking about nuclear energy, we're talking about nuclear technology and knowledge. Today, everyone knows that it has various applications and is among the fundamental and foundational sciences. It has diverse applications and is strategic for the country. Therefore, the country must focus on the development of nuclear science, even though it has been repeatedly emphasized, mentioned, and even examined that Iran's nuclear program is a peaceful program. Unlike many other countries, where their primary use of nuclear technology is for military purposes and violates human rights, Iran has a peaceful program. Today, good information is provided that exploitation must take place in various fields, including agriculture. Iran, like other countries, cannot and should not be deprived of using this knowledge and technology to secure the interests of its people and the residents of its cities. The second issue here is that knowledge, especially cutting-edge technologies, is empowering. Empowerment has various aspects, with the most significant being independence for powerful countries. These countries strongly resist dependence and do not want other countries to become independent. They always prefer to be in need and are inclined to maintain dependencies, reaching out to other countries.
Right. Well, your father wasn't the first scientist, as I just said, to be assassinated. And it was by the American and Israeli, of course, regimes. And these assassinations were not only to slow down, to halt the progress of individual projects, but also to send a message to others not to go into that field, not to do that. Do you think that they have been effective in sending that message to others or not?
Perhaps it was the morning after his martyrdom, a Saturday morning, when I explicitly, in the first interview I had with some television networks, wholeheartedly stated the following sentence: an arrogant regime such as Israel should fear the martyred Mohsen Fakhrizadeh as much as it feared him alive. This is a reality, at least in the events after the martyrdom, where in fact when we complete the puzzle of the assassinations, we come to two points. Firstly, they are genuinely still afraid of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, and now they fear him even more. Secondly, the very subtle message of the Supreme Leader regarding his actions and activities, illustrating how impactful one can be not only within the geographical boundaries of their own country, but far beyond. One could boldly say that he was not just an Iranian scientist, but one of the greatest scientists of his time in the Islamic world. This is an undeniable fact. Some of the work he did was closely tied to his personality, knowledge, and capabilities. Naturally, after his martyrdom, these tasks cannot continue, or if they do, they may continue with less power or force. In certain areas, given his high managerial abilities, his work on succession planning and establishing suitable structures or projects and other matters would not necessarily come to a complete halt with his martyrdom. We certainly hope that, following the explicit orders of the leadership, all his scientific and technical activities in all areas he was involved in will continue. I would like to mention a point related to this matter which may be relevant to your question. At the beginning of the message announced by the Supreme Leader the day after the martyrdom of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, he states, an outstanding and distinguished nuclear and defense scientist. But where he wanted to say, go and carry out his work, he did not say, go and carry out his nuclear work or go and carry out his defense work, because the Supreme Leader knew perfectly well in which areas he was capable. Where he wanted to give orders for his activities, he used the phrase go and pursue his work seriously. Let the officials follow up on all his scientific and technical work in all areas he was engaged in. We hope that following this strict order of the Supreme Leader, the work will proceed well. I have said this many times. Iran has shown that the youth within its borders are all capable and worthy. This soil has nurtured Soleimani. This soil has nurtured Fakhrizadeh. This soil will never be devoid of individuals like Fakhrizadeh, and God willing, the work will proceed smoothly.
Do you have any final comments? I mean, if we look at the overall situation of the Islamic Republic of Iran now and technology, are you optimistic about the future of Iran?
Exactly. In any case, over the past 40 years, we have demonstrated that we can open the greatest peaks of knowledge and technology in various fields from within ourselves and relying on our own capabilities. This includes nuclear technology, nanotechnology, stem cells, computer science, and today, in artificial intelligence and more. We have international documentation, scientific articles published by Iranian youth in emerging fields demonstrate that Iran is highly capable and performs well. We have witnessed significant growth and advancements, and we envision a bright future for our country. In the end, the point I want to make is that the assassination of Martyr Fakhrizadeh and those like them is a blow not only to Iran or the Islamic world, but to human society. We lost a scientist, and they assassinated a scientist who was engaged in fundamental and foundational activities in the field of science, contributing to the beneficial development of human society. These assassinations occur to achieve malicious goals that certain groups have, not for the sake of human society or even for a specific nation. I emphasize that these assassinations occur for the sake of goals that certain groups have. Hopefully, the global community will wake up to this awareness and we will witness the confrontation with such behaviors, the result of which is a violation of the human rights of different nations and a gross violation of human rights in general.
Yes, we hope so. Thank you both for being with me, Dr. Mehdi and Dr. Hamid Fakhrizadeh. I appreciate you being with me.
Thank you so much.
We'll be right back with more of the program. And thank you, viewers, for staying with us. Don't go away. There's more to the show. Stay tuned.
Now, some may ask, with so much pressure on Iran to stop its peaceful nuclear program, with all these sanctions and the sabotage of Iran's nuclear facilities and the assassination of Iran scientists and more, why doesn't the Islamic Republic just give up on its nuclear program? So let's go over a few reasons. Now, one of the major uses of nuclear energy is in the production of electricity. France, for instance, gets 70% of its electricity from nuclear energy. Now, for Iran, a country with a dry climate, using nuclear energy instead of hydropower plants is ideal, and it's dedicated at least 5 nuclear power plants to the production of electricity. This technology has many uses in the agricultural industry, from genetic modification to pest control using sterilization to water usage control and much more. Now, these are just some of the reasons that the Islamic Republic insists on making use of nuclear technology like other countries, and it has the right to do so. But it's not really about nuclear energy. Over the years, many sanctions have been placed on various other types of technology in Iran as well. The main goal is to keep the Islamic Republic of Iran from progressing, a goal that has clearly failed.
Fakhrizadeh, the Iranian nuclear physicist, vaccine developer, university professor, and more, is no longer amongst us. Now he's reached his dreams of martyrdom while fulfilling what he deemed the holy mission of working to advance his country and serving his people, the dream of giving everything he had for the worthiest cause he knew. Now, today, the same criminal entity that took the life of Fakhrizadeh continues to commit a genocide in Palestine. The same entity that accused the Islamic Republic of Iran of reaching for nuclear bombs has dropped over 40,000 tons of explosives on the Gaza Strip alone, breaking the record of American nuclear bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in death and destruction. But just as the mass murder of Palestinians has not stopped their resistance against Israeli occupation, the assassination of Iranian scientists has only made Iranians more determined to advance their country through their peaceful nuclear program. Well, Iran has certainly lost a few heroes, but the Israeli regime has lost face to millions of people who are taking to the streets to denounce its crimes across the world. And it's just as Imam Khomeini, the late leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, had said, "Go ahead and murder us. It will only awaken the masses."
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
The former British Prime Minister Gordon Brown has said Britain is in the throes of a hidden poverty epidemic, with the worst affected households living in squalor and going without food, heating, and everyday basics. We take a look at some of the World Press and Media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us.